highway.
Radio.
Get your kicks on Route
66. Hey, everybody. Yes, we're getting our kicks today on Route 66. That was, believe it or not, Nat King Cole. It's like a jazzy, after Rastaman Vibration. Last week. Now we're going real jazzy. This is Rebooting the News number 66.
And, hi, Dave.
Hi, Jay.
It's Jay Rosen.
We have a beaming guest here today.
We've got a guest here, which we want to introduce as soon as possible so people know.
Well, why don't you introduce him, Jay?
Ryan Tate, a reporter for Gawker Media, is here with us. Welcome, Ryan.
Hi, thanks.
He's also a listener to Rebooting the News, am I right?
Absolutely, every week.
And a young journalist with a rising profile, I think that's fair to say.
Gosh.
Ryan, tell us your origin story. How did you get into journalism, and why did you get into journalism?
I actually started at the student paper at UC Berkeley, and basically, you know, I took 6 years to graduate because I was spending all my time there. Interned at I started freelancing actually for the Wall Street Journal. They had a California section that was sort of focused specifically on news from California. And then after that, I graduated at a great time to go into journalism. It was 2000, so there's plenty of jobs. And I went to Upside, which had been sort of a little bit like what Valley was. Yeah, I was at Upside.
Upside was definitely a little bit like Valley, like sort of irreverent, but better. It was much better than Valley was. God, that's embarrassing.
Well, I mean, they were trying to be like the Rolling Stone of Silicon Valley.
They had the best cover I've ever seen any magazine ever had, and it was a picture of John Sculley the CEO of Apple, playing a little sandbox with his toys, and the headline said, headline said, "Has Silicon Valley gone pussy?" and it was on the cover of Upside. It did raise a few eyebrows, actually.
They would do stuff like that.
Okay, Upside then.
And then
move it along here.
Okay, and then Upside went under, and then it was Business 2.0, and then Contra Costa Times. I got into sort of local, Business 2.0, sort of folded. I wasn't there when it folded, but it was already starting to implode a little bit. And so I went into print and specifically away from tech and into sort of real estate and general business news for a while. So I was at the Contra Costa Times, which is a Knight Ridder paper sort of east of San Francisco, and then San Francisco Business Times for 5 or 6 years, which is a Newhouse owned, it's sort of part of the Advance Publications empire. It's a weekly business paper out in San Francisco. And then Gawker.
So
in 2008.
2008. How and why did you hook on with Gawker?
So this is a little fun. I mean, it's a fun story to tell, at least for me, in that they posted a job listing, and I made fun of the job listing. I sort of posted a mock. I sort of rewrote it in my own words, sort of making fun of it, not really thinking I was applying for the job. And actually, very few people saw it because I was out on the West Coast and everyone had pretty much gone home for the day. But I later found out that Richard Blakely, who's now the video editor sort of for all the Gawker sites, had sort of spotted this comment, forwarded it to a few people, Corey Sika and I guess to Nick. And they ended up liking this. Nick sort of likes when you poke him. He's sort of a little masochistic. He likes, I guess he sort of likes sass. And he likes being sassed.
That's the story he told me, though.
No, what did he say?
No, he said it was a more interesting story, actually.
Maybe he just told it better.
No, different story. He said that, and this is, I can relate to this, because he said that you were a commenter, frequent commenter on the Gawker sites, and that's how they got to know you. And in fact, that's how I got to know you, too, because he's a frequent commenter on Scripting News going way back. Yeah. And, we've talked a lot about commenting on this show, about, sort of the dismal state of comments. Well, guys like Ryan are the bright light. It's sort of like you want, 20 or 30 people like this, and all of a sudden the discourse on a blog might actually be worth it,
the cream of the commentary.
Yeah, and so, yes. And I would, if I had jobs to offer for people writing for Scripting News, there, you know, there would be no question he would be one of the people I would offer it to. And when Nick told me this story, I said, that just makes perfect sense. And I thought this was an interesting story for Rebooting the News because, mm-hmm. you know, this is sort of the process by which, you know, I mean, he has all the credentials, right? You know, he's had, you know, he's been the intern and he's written for the, you know, Berkeley, the Cal paper and so forth. But in the end, he gets his current job, not because of any of his credentials. And I think if you asked people at Gawker, maybe they care a little bit about the credentials. I don't know.
But Nick definitely didn't. In fact, right. when we interviewed, he said, I don't even want to know right. if you went to college or where you got your degree, or right. even if you have a degree.
I don't doubt that.
Den is always hired off of your blog writing. He doesn't want to care. He doesn't care about your resume.
Which is, I think, a kind of a dismal thing, I guess, maybe if you're at a journalism school, but which we happen to be sitting in one right now. But
no, I tell my students that all the time,
yeah.
that this is how Denton hires us.
Right. I mean, if you've got a blog, he will read, you know, if yeah. you've got a blog.
But like the point is that you can make a career for yourself by simply rebooting yourself.
Yeah.
By just starting to do the
thing. Bootstrapping your own
career.
That's
right. You start yeah. doing the thing that you want to do.
Don't wait.
And, right. You don't wait.
Yeah, Richard, I'm actually the second commenter who worked at Gawker. Richard Lawson also got his job the same way. Although he was working in the sales department, but he was an anonymous commenter. So
it also got you a seat on Rebooting the News.
Coveted.
A really good commenter, you yeah. know, pays off.
Many bloggers have started that way. They start as commenters, and then they become guest bloggers. Nate Silver, for example, mm-hmm. started on Daily Kos.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. So we want to talk with you, Ryan, about some of the stories that you've covered when you're at Gawker, because, you know, from your point of view, there was, and I've made a list of some of them, but I'm sure it's like a small fraction of what you've done. AntennaGate, of course, is fresh and comes to mind. That's the whole thing about, you know, Apple selling a phone that wasn't really working very well as a phone for people. Now, you guys don't worry a whole lot about access, right? When you're
yeah, that's fair to say.
Maybe you can explain how your philosophy about that.
I mean, Gizmodo, just for the record, I mean, the AntennaGate, you know, Gizmodo really gets the credit for that. And specifically, actually, the readers of Gizmodo really, really, really drove that story. And a lot of the commenters, as we were talking about before.
Really?
Yeah,
so that
was very...
If
you look at how it's that post, the how sort of Gizmodo broke that, they had actually been disinvited from the sort of Macworld event where this phone was unveiled. Disinvited from a lot of events, and they had sort of learned to cover it from the outside, reading other blogs, soliciting right. tips from readers. So the AntennaGate was kind of just an organically came out of that. We started hearing more and more from readers who had these problems.
So it
right
didn't break
it
with
out.
The announcement, right? It didn't break
right.
with the announcement.
With the readers.
And David Pogue and Walter Mossberg
right.
and those guys, they didn't catch it, right?
Right?
it had to get to the users before the story really broke, and you guys were positioned.
Yeah.
To catch that, because you didn't have any other, you presumably weren't given one of these units.
Some
to
of
play
it's
with.
Just opening the mail. I mean, a lot of times we'll get stuff that has been sent to other people, but we're constantly, you know, reading, you know, opening our mail and reading the stuff, and so they really jumped on it. And I thought that was a great example of how not having the access actually can be a better thing.
It's
than
called
being on
the journalism
inside.
Of the inbox.
Yeah, or
it's
you know,
very
in this,
effective
and in this case, it was you know, you start posting on, and then you start getting more. So
right.
it's like yes, you open your mail, but then you also sort of you know do some digging, and you start if you have a unit, you do some testing, and then you sort of ask readers for more information. And
well, you know what interested me about this access question, and we do want to develop this a little bit, is that Nick Denton's idea when he started Gawker Media. Is a very powerful idea. The founding insight of the company was that journalists are a lot more interesting to listen to when you talk to them in a bar than they are when you read their writing because they know a lot more than they put into their work.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So what accounts for the difference between what they know, what they can tell you in the bar, and what they put into their work? Well, it's the codes of professional journalism,
Well, this is the Michael Hastings story, and Michael Hastings is in the next room. He's the Rolling Stone reporter that broke the story about General McChrystal.
I did not know that was Michael Hastings.
Yeah, that's
who
that is.
No wonder we have such a big crowd here today at NYU.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I mean, so we've got the story coming at us from all sides. I mean, there was a perfect example. When I heard him interviewed, I forget what, maybe it was Fresh Air or something like that. He said basically, what you just said. I'm reporting the thing that everybody in the bar knows.
Right.
You know, I just didn't worry about whether I would keep the access or not.
So that was Denton's idea is, well, wait a minute. What if we try to eliminate that gap, right?
Yeah,
between
absolutely.
I love that. I love it.
And what you put. So tell us, like, how that works at Gawker and how that makes your approach a little bit different than maybe the trade press or the Wall Street Journal press.
I mean, I think some of it is willing to say things that you kind of, that are opinions, or they're from intuition, and you know, being transparent about it while you're doing it, and feeling like that gives you a little bit more license. Like a lot of times when I was at traditional newspapers, it would be like what you're talking about. There'd be a discussion, there'd be a budget meeting, and the reporter would say, you know, would describe the story, and you'd be like, wow, that's a blockbuster, and then it would come out, and it would just be this sort of shadow game of they would be implying things but not actually saying them.
Right.
They would just be trying to lead you to a conclusion, but they were so coy that you're like, well, anyone who wasn't in that budget meeting isn't going to know what you're trying to say, because you're not coming out and saying it.
Getting sources to say what you want.
Yeah, so I guess the idea at Gawker is that, you know, if you're trying to say something with a story, don't just arrange the facts that way. Actually come out and say, this is what I'm trying, you know, I don't have maybe conclusive evidence of what I'm trying to lead you to, but this is what I'm trying to lead you to. And here, you know, here's where my argument is weak, and here's what I'm uncertain of. But here's where I'm getting at. One example of that would be when Facebook changed its privacy settings the last time around. I think early this year, I did an item saying, this smells like a trap. And I said, you know, this is largely a speculative post, and I don't really have a ton of evidence for this. But here's, you know, here's like maybe eight things. If you know, here's Facebook. Here's like four things that Facebook has done in the past that would indicate to me that they are going to roll back privacy in a big way. Mm-hmm. Here's something from the announcement that indicates to me they're going to roll back privacy in a big way. You know, and here's, you know, the fact that they're not going to tell us for another week indicates to me they're going to, this was kind of before they had actually done it. They had kind of put out this blog post saying maybe we're going to do it. And, you know, basically everything in that post came to pass. They were basically trying to sort of make a grab for user privacy. And it might not have worked out that way, but we at least tried to be very clear on what we knew and what we didn't know. But not hold back and not say it because we weren't 100% sure. Just kind of just level with the reader and say, this is where we're coming from, and these are the dots we're trying to connect. And if we're wrong, tell us we're wrong.
I like your phrase, level with the reader, because the part of the origin of this style is a leveling between the journalists and the readers, in the sense that what you're really saying is, look, here's what we know. What do you know?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And very often, if you do say that and people know that you're serious about it, here's what we know, what do you know, they'll tell you what they know. And sometimes that can be fit into the picture. That's a different way of, we have the story. You know, it's different than the attempt to be authoritative.
And that's totally how it unfolded. I mean, you know, as the things, we were hearing about changes before they were actually announced because that initial post actually, you know, a lot of people saw it. It got picked up. It, you know, a lot of actual Facebook users who were concerned about privacy read it. And then when they saw something change in the service, they let us know. And if we were able to verify it or able, you know, it was pretty easy to test, you know, then we'd have our next story. And it just kept getting bigger and bigger. And so we had more and more people sending us information.
What if that got institutionalized? That, you know, you started a publication specifically with that disclaimer in mind. You know?
Which disclaimer?
Well, I'm sort of thinking out loud here. I mean, suppose you said, we're not going to ever accept a review unit. This goes back to what we were talking about with
Consumer Reports.
Right.
Yeah.
We're not going to accept a review unit. We can afford to do this because we're going to staff this publication with the users of the products. And so when the product actually hits the market, you won't ever hear about a product until it's actually for sale, because we won't be able to get it until it's actually for sale.
Right.
And however, once it is for sale, you're going to get an exhaustive review of it almost real time, you know, and you're going to find out what's happening, you know, with this product in the hands, but get systematic about it.
Right.
You know, we're conditioned to expect that now. I almost never buy a product that I can't read reviews about beforehand. I don't go to restaurants before I can read a review. I mean, I have Yelp for that. I have Amazon and their reviews, and so forth. But these consumer products that are newsmakers, I mean, this is how you marginalize. Ultimately, I think this is how the rebooted news process is going to marginalize all the inside footsie, inside baseball, you know, Church of the Savvy, to use your term, Jay,
yeah.
You know, it's how it's all going to get pushed aside.
Well, Gawker is very much part of that wave.
Right, right. But the suggestion...
Which is not to say they don't like exclusive stories. They do, but they usually don't get them through these access games.
Do they get exclusive stories? From the insiders,
no,
from
we,
the people who...
Yeah, I mean, we've done, you know, Gizmodo's done review stories where they get units, you know...
But not like what TechCrunch gets. I mean, TechCrunch gets the stories, you know...
And they have
Switch. What did you think about the whole Angelgate thing? Did you think that that was a real story? Or
I actually listened to your take that week, yeah. But I had a different... You know, I actually was impressed with Mike that he had done it. I agreed with you that I'd have loved to have seen names. You know, he should have named the people, but I thought this was, you know, where Arrington, for people who don't know, named these angels who were colluding, angel investors who were sort of allegedly colluding to fix terms. But, I thought it was... In his world, those are the sort of people who maybe are feeding a lot of the stories and are sources for him. So I admire someone who's pushing back against their sources.
Well, we have a little bit of extra information since the last time we talked about this.
We do?
Yes, we do.
I didn't follow that. What is it?
TechCrunch got acquired by AOL.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and right. And so there's a backstory to this whole Angelgate thing because we didn't know that while Angelgate was coming out.
Mm-hmm.
But he did. He didn't know that he was getting acquired for certain because you never do know until it's actually signed, right?
Yeah.
But he knew it was coming along, it was moving along pretty fast, and that it was, like, looking pretty good.
Yeah.
So there's a backstory here that maybe there's a change, maybe this is part of, you know, I thought, without knowing anything about an acquisition of TechCrunch by AOL, that this was just sort of like, I don't know. I didn't buy it. It didn't seem very sincere to me because I know that he's on the inside on a lot of these things. And so tell us, please, what does this mean about future coverage about these people? Are we to expect that you're going to be blowing their secrets more frequently now? Or are you going to be playing, you know, the inside?
You mean on my side? Or
No. I'm talking about Arrington. Right,
yeah.
Now, because he's part of AOL and doesn't need them as much.
Well, I wonder...
Maybe we can expect some more hard-hitting journalism. On the other hand, what's his incentive to be so hard hitting now? You know, he's gotten his price, presumably. He's on a earnout now. You know, all he has to do is stick around for X months or years to get paid the money that he, you know.
But he strikes me as a guy who likes stirring things up. I mean, he was a lawyer. You probably know more of the story than I do since you've known him for a while, but he was a lawyer who kind of left law to go into this sort of TechCrunch, you know, stirring the stuff. You know, pushing the boundaries.
I don't really understand. No.
Muckraking. So he seems to like it, and I wonder if it wasn't a test of AOL. Like,
who was
you know,
it? Mitch Kapor.
Let me show them the kind of stories I do to make sure that they're going to be comfortable with it.
Oh,
it's pure speculation, but I mean, you know,
I
that by the way always happens
him.
When there are acquisitions. I mean, I've been acquired, okay, and I learned I got acquired by a company that does acquisitions almost like that was their business, and. I heard that basically that very often happens, that as the acquisition's happening in the first weeks after the acquisition, you'll often see a big spike in sales numbers because people want to show off to the new company, you know, and it's like, we want to look really good right now, and then, you know, the shit hits the fan a little bit later. You know, Mitch Kapor asked a great question, by the way, on his Twitter feed. He asked, anybody want to put down bets on how long Mike Arrington lasts at AOL?
That's what I was going to say. I cannot imagine him.
No, the longevity of an entrepreneur, like especially, I mean, he's not an exceptional entrepreneur. He's right in the middle. You know, entrepreneurs are like that. You know, mm-hmm. You don't want to be sitting there in the. And in fact, I wrote a piece about his first company meeting. You know, in the new company, and while the piece was, you know, in its like. You know, I had been up for 5 minutes. Out comes his piece, okay, about the first company meeting. And I go, yeah, I remember exactly what that was like. What could seem more irrelevant than being immersed in the minutiae of this company that you don't give one whit about,
mm-hmm.
You know? And as the entrepreneur, as the CEO, what you want is you want something tough to chew on. I want something to play with, you know, it's like a dog with the chew toy, you know, give me something to play with, really meaty.
I just hope he's able to maintain the voice that he's, you know, to the extent that TechCrunch and he have been breaking some, you know, with Zynga and this Angelgate thing, they've been breaking some good stories and they've maintained a real voice. And I just hope they're able to do it once they disappear, you know, once they get swallowed into AOL, are they going to be able to, not necessarily because they're going to get censored, but just it's a large organization.
I have a lot of doubts about that too, but here's what I think is interesting about it. AOL right now is not only the biggest hirer of journalists out there right now, but they are doing something which doesn't happen very often, which is they are creating an editorial culture out of a company that didn't really have one. They're becoming a journalism company, a news company.
Interesting. Yeah.
And it's different when an old media company extends itself to the web or, you know, develops new products. It's extending an existing culture. But that's not what AOL is doing. It's trying to create a journalistic culture from the tools and facts of the web.
So, Jay, the opportunity for Arrington then might be to be a central figure in that
exactly
in
that's
that
my
establishment.
Point.
I mean, that, you know, sort
well,
of like
to set the pace or tone for that new editorial.
So, what are the other elements? And Gadget, of course, is part of it. And the Seed things.
Seed.com, which is a huge network of freelancers.
Right.
They also have a bunch of other sites like Politics Daily, which are more traditional type news sites.
I honestly don't see that happening. I mean, I had somebody once describe to me the kind of people that Arrington likes to have working for him as being people that he can push around. I mean, that's actually how it was described to me, that he doesn't like people who have too much independence.
Well, I have no idea, but he also has to be prepared to be pushed around. I mean, he's now part of a big company.
See, that's the problem. That's where I think
I don't see this marriage lasting that long.
Yeah.
But he might.
That
be
was
able
my problem with Symantec too. Is that the first day I had to take orders and do something that I found really distasteful, I didn't want to do it, and I almost said, "Yeah, well, you know, all right, I'll do it."
Well, that's pretty direct of you. That's a good self insight day.
That I didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
That's good. Do you know how long I lasted at this company?
I would say not very long at all.
6 months.
Yeah.
And most of that time was spent at home plotting my next move.
Right.
It's like,
I mean, and I can't speak on his behalf, but we had a guy, John Cook, who went to Yahoo, and his departure from Yahoo has been covered. In a few news reports, because there were some, I think, some quotes that he gave about the level of sort of bureaucracy that he saw at Yahoo, and the fact that he wanted to write stories, and he felt like he was being blocked all the time. They thought it was too opinionated, or it was too, you know, for whatever reason, they didn't want to do the story. So, you know, I look at AOL and I wonder, well, just because they're a tech company and they don't have this sort of old media baggage, doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to do. You know, that they're going to be innovative because they have other products. They have other things they do besides media. Now, you know, maybe Tim Armstrong, as he turns the company away from this modem business that they have, will be so focused on content, he'll do a really good job. But I just haven't been super impressed with what I've seen. I mean, Daily Finance, they've got some strong writers. It's a good site, but it doesn't seem to have really taken off. And their politics site also seems a little weak.
Dreary,
and
yeah.
Yeah, Ryan, I look at Yahoo and I don't see, they do huge
Yahoo's
traffic.
Yahoo's also trying to create an editorial culture.
They are. No, I think it's commendable that they are.
But so far, we don't know what that's going to be.
But what's come out of it, right? What's come out of it is really interesting. Whereas someone like, Arianna Huffington, who this is all she does, there's been some really interesting, I'm not always a fan of the Huffington Post, I think there's big flaws in it, but there have definitely been things that have come out of Huffington Post, like your Off the Bus project, the Citizen Journalism project, that really transformed, I think, the 2008 election.
Well that
And I think that's partly because she's not distracted by other things. And I think that's one of Nick's strengths as well. He's
yeah,
not distracted
they're very
by
focused.
Other parts of the business.
Right.
This is all they're doing.
Did you take note of the New York Times reporter, Peter Goodman, who left the New York Times for the Huffington Post and the reasoning he gave for doing so? Did you notice that, Dave?
No.
I saw that,
man,
yeah.
This is so fascinating. This, more than anything else, this indicated to me what kind of shifts are going on within the profession of journalism and its sort of prestige ladder, right? Mm-hmm. So this guy, Peter Goodman, who is a national economic correspondent for the New York Times, was lured away from the New York Times to take a job writing about business and economics for the Huffington Post. And in explaining why he did that, he said that with a dysfunctional political system, old conventional notions of fairness make it hard to tell readers directly what's going on. This is a chance for me to explore solutions in my economic reporting, and he said, not to have to launder my views through sources. And the reason he was leaving, essentially, was what he's saying is I want to be able to tell what I think is the truth directly to readers without having to go through these conventions of journalism that make me put my views in the mouth of an expert professor and balance when it's not really balanced.
That's what I've always been saying that they've been doing, you know, and you being used as a foil for that is not.
But here's right. somebody, a star correspondent of the New York Times, saying, I can't deal with this anymore.
And there have been about three or four people from the Washington Post who have also gone over there to the Huffington Post. Larry Roberts, their investigations editor, Dan Frumkin.
Yeah,
well, Frumkin
he went
was
to
not
Huffington
a direct,
Post investigative fund, but he left.
Okay, that's right, yeah. That's, I've heard that. But there have been several of these cases of people going in that direction.
Because
Thomas Hetzel was also...
Because they realized that the constrictions of conventional journalism are actually preventing them from being truth tellers.
Right.
That's
yeah.
what he's saying.
Yeah. It's a tragedy, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's tragic. Yeah.
And there's also the basic economics too, though. I mean, if you're at the New York Times and you're looking at the financial situation that they're in and some of the loans they've taken on, and then you look at another business that's growing, particularly if you're younger, where are you going to go? Where's the advancement for opportunity? Are you, you know, do you stay
well, if the Times
at this organization
job,
that has a sterling reputation financial...
Yeah, so you, that begs the question. If you got a job offer for the New York Times to be a reporter for the Times today, assuming that all other parts of the package were comparable, what would you say? Yeah,
this
you see?
This is a fantasy land, but I mean...
I have a funny feeling you don't even need to answer that question.
Well, tell him you don't respond to hypotheticals.
Yeah, exactly.
He's beaming, Dave. He's beaming.
Oh, poor Ryan. Yeah. You can't answer that question. I get it. But the hesitation there was palpable.
Well, yeah, but but if you're at one of these organizations, you have that on your resume at that point, right? So
if I was thinking about it,
it's like, well, you know, that would certainly enhance.
That's
my,
a good answer.
It would certainly enhance my resume. But if I was already there, you know, it's actually I would think. Less of a compelling case because now you've got it, it's down, and you know now you can pretty much do whatever you want.
The Times has to get very, very flexible on these things, and too many of the things that they should be trying out right now, they don't try out because they aren't the way they've always done things. They don't necessarily create conflicts for them, they just are unusual ideas, and they don't want to bend, and that's bending now is an absolute requirement. You can't navigate in this situation without an awful lot of flexibility.
Dave, what else is on your list there of items we had for Ryan to talk about?
Well, I don't know about Ryan so much as things that we have to continue to look at. Well, we were going to talk a little bit about the Facebook movie. Right?
Oh, yeah.
You wanted to mention that because you got to look at it. Now I've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
Had some observations about that. Not anything earth-shaking.
What did you think?
Well, having been, an insider in the places, in both of the places that this story takes place, which is Cambridge, Massachusetts.
In 2003.
And Harvard. In 2003, I was actually there. And in Silicon...
At the Berkman Center.
Yep. And Silicon Valley for quite a bit longer. It's a caricature of those places and of those situations. They're, you know, some of the central ideas in the movie, in the plot of the movie, simply are unbelievable. Couldn't have happened.
Mm-hmm.
A lawyer isn't going to allow a client of his to push another founder out of a company without compensation. You don't do that. You don't do it for the simple reason... Well, for the reason, I don't want to spoil the movie, but although it's not a hell of a huge spoiler, you don't do it because what happens is then they sue you and they win.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might as well just go ahead factor that in. Aside from that, you always want to do what's fair, right? And this guy. So I've had everybody that started a company in Silicon Valley has made the mistake that Zuckerberg made. You always end up with hangers-on. Because in the early days of a company, it's lonely, and you need friends around, and you want to believe that everybody is as motivated as you are, and the sad truth is they're not. They don't have the vision. They don't see where you're headed. They don't have the intuition and trust. I mean, that was the beautiful thing about the story, I thought. They actually did capture that, although I don't think they understood it, that Zuckerberg had that thing there that a good entrepreneur has, which is an intuitive feel for where this thing is headed and
right.
and when is the right time to turn this corner of becoming commercial, you know?
You know, David Carr pointed out that often in the film you see Zuckerberg looking out the window when the lawyers are, like, arguing.
Yeah.
Looking off into space.
Yeah.
And that communicates what you're talking about, is that his vision is
Well, he even said it
longer.
At one point, right. I mean, he said at one point, you know, he said, the lawyer asked him, do you respect me? And he said, no, I don't respect you.
Yeah.
You don't understand what the hell you're talking about.
Yeah, you don't know what this company is.
My attention is mostly in the office where it belongs. And, you know, and the agony of the movie, of the proponent, you know, the author of the script, his point of view is, The people who have right on their side are the people who know the least about what's going on, which are the lawyers.
Yeah.
The lawyers are the heroes of his story.
Right.
Ugh.
That
was
the like, theme of Lessig's review.
Yeah, well, I thought Lessig nailed it. And you know, yeah, I mean,
Here's some things that really seem strange to me, Dave. First of all, and this offends me, that Sorkin is proud of the fact that he doesn't use Facebook.
Yeah,
and doesn't
no kidding.
Know about
What's the problem with that?
That's like the opposite of my values. My values are, like, if you're going to write about something, if you're going to, even if you're going to fictionalize it, you submerge yourself in it. You find out about it. Doesn't mean that you have
Jay,
to.
Jay, that's not even controversial in acting.
Of course it's not controversial. But
that's called method acting. I mean, it's like you immerse yourself.
It's called research.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
It's called immersion reporting, right? So that part really bothered me. And then, like, the story is, I believe, the story that actually happened is
much
very interesting.
Yep.
So why do you need these fake things in there? Like, he did it to get back at a girl, and he did it to get into this club at Harvard, which was totally made up. Like, why? And if you want to fictionalize the story of Zuckerberg and Facebook, well, I understand that. Then you do what Orson Welles did. You create a character with a different name. You create a company with a different name. You say it's based on Facebook, but really it's an exploration of human nature or whatever. But it seems that they want it both ways. They want the verisimilitude of a movie that's about this company and this guy. And then they want to say, yeah, well, we made all this shit up.
No, it backfires on him. It backfires on him anyway. This is the piece I wrote this morning after watching, you know, how the opinion about this has settled in and sort of getting a better...
Everyone thinks it's great.
Well, it's good for Zuckerberg. I mean, it
is good for Zuckerberg.
You know,
for sure.
One thing
Absolutely.
I've observed is that, okay, so first of all, it puts him right on top of the heap. It also puts him, you know, it really helps to marginalize Steve Jobs, Bill Gates.
Oh, it makes him a cultural star.
Right.
Absolutely.
Bill Gates has pushed himself out to pasture.
Gates is.
This is his heir apparent. In fact, they even say it in the movie at one point. They even say that, you know, this is, you know, Bill Gates is on stage. The actor playing Bill Gates says, the next Bill Gates could even be in the audience.
Right.
And everybody thinks, well, that's Zuckerberg, of
right.
course. And in fact, this movie does actually do that.
Yeah,
and
the passing of a torch.
And all you have to say is that what Zuckerberg has to do is just shrug it off and show that he still has a sense of humor and he can take a hit. And, you know, and
it's not a hit.
Well, it's a little hit.
I don't think it's a hit.
It's not much of a hit because at the end of the movie they say, because the premise of the movie, the beginning of the movie, okay, if you recall the opening scene, which is actually a pretty good scene, right?
It is a good scene.
Yeah, you know, it ends with, you're an asshole, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of convincing. You go, but, and every guy who's ever been in his shoes, and a lot of us have, right, you know, wants to say, but he's just like 16 years old, and that's awkwardness. That's not an asshole. He just doesn't know what.
He doesn't know how to talk to girls.
Yeah, he doesn't know how to talk to girls. You know, go ahead and sue me. You know,
right.
He wants to get laid. He likes this girl.
Maybe if girls were easier to talk to, he wouldn't be such an asshole.
He doesn't know what to say. So okay, great. He's an asshole, and the whole movie is. We finally, at one moment, there's one moment when you realize he's not an asshole at all. He's his feelings are hurt right now. He's sitting there wondering how. Did I create this mess? This guy, Eduardo, he wasn't so bad to me. He just didn't know what he was doing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You could see all that form, that thought bubble form over his head, right? And at the end of the movie, what's the closing line? Hey, you're not such an asshole after all.
Yeah. Brian, you read the script, right?
Yeah, I read the script. I haven't
seen
the movie
yet. What
did you
think
when you read the script?
Huh?
Every stage in this, I've been amazed at how interesting he's able. I think, you know, the Mazurich, who wrote the original book, Sorkin, who wrote the script, have been geniuses at making what is fundamentally very boring industry and very boring, I think, fairly boring in the, not to me, but to the general public, process of creating basically a website into something that's a page-turner. I mean, I plowed through the book, I plowed through the script. You know, I was in awe of the first trailer that leaked with that, you know, that Creep song. And I think, you know, I would not be surprised if Zuckerberg ends up very grateful at this movie simply for the fact that it makes it seem so much more glamorous, I think, than real life is. And, you know, my question for you guys, as someone who hasn't actually seen it yet, is, was the movie entertaining? Because I certainly did not get the impression they were out to make a factual movie, but, you know, if it gets people to watch.
As Obama would say, it was entertaining enough.
It was entertaining, right?
It wasn't like the Departed, you know? I mean, The Departed was, to me, like the ultimate entertaining, sit on the edge of your seat, you never know what they're going to do type movie, right? To me, that was like, you know, I couldn't get enough of that. This was not that.
I think it's a pretty good movie.
I don't think anything
that makes it entertaining was sustained by the lies in the film. I don't get that.
I mean, Peter,
why do you need him to be so interested in Harvard clubs? It doesn't actually explain a damn thing.
I don't even get that he was all that interested in the Harvard clubs.
But they made it up.
Where in the movie was? I mean, maybe let's not get into too much detail here, but where in the movie did you get the idea that the character Zuckerberg was so interested in the clubs?
It's in there. I can't remember exactly.
It's in the opening speech. He talks about how, you know, right, in the clubs, and
right?
But that's it.
But
after that, it's like he almost ignores it. He goes into the party on Caribbean night and pulls the guy out into the cold so he can tell him about the website, not so that he wanted to date the girls that were there. You know, he wanted to tell him about this idea that he had.
All right.
I mean, he was a geek. I could totally relate to that, okay? The geekness
in
Zuckerberg.
Geek.
I could give him a big hug and say, you know, thank God there's still guys like you out there who are thinking this way, you know?
I mean, he's like an 18-year-old coding PHP in his dorm room. I mean, how do you... I'm just amazed they made that into a movie.
It's just genius.
It's lovable, but Ryan's saying it's not dramatic.
It's not dramatic. No, I agree. Yeah. It's very lovable.
They made it dramatic.
And I like Peter Thiel's take. Peter Thiel, the original angel investor in Facebook, says he thinks this will be like Wall Street was for investment banking. Like that this will draw people into the... You know, it'll encourage more people to try to be entrepreneurs.
Maybe. And that would, of course, be a good thing. Now, that leads right into... the hackathon question.
Okay.
It's like, you know, we're doing a
hackathon. You got a beef with hackathons?
I don't really have a beef, but I'm fascinated by them.
Well, let's explain what they are first.
Okay, a hackathon is, the best I can explain it, is you get a bunch of, you don't get a bunch of programmers. You announce that you're having a hackathon, okay? And you go out and buy a bunch of Jolt Cola and pizza and burritos and whatever, and you get yourself a big room, and you reserve it for 24 hours, okay?
Uh-huh. And then?
And then... hopefully, a bunch of programmers show up, and then they sit down, they form little teams, and they come up with ideas, and then they spend, you know, whatever. They spend 18 hours writing these things up, and at the end, you have a big, you know, sort of, everybody gets up and presents their ideas, and there's a panel of judges, and the judges discuss each idea, and then at the end, somebody gets a prize, right?
And they try to make stuff.
Well, yeah. But
build stuff.
The stuff that they build is... you know, the question is, what do they build? Is there anything actually that happens at these things is worth a damn? Okay, mm-hmm. And I don't really know. People have varying answers about that. I don't think there's ever been a startup that's come out of these things yet. That is the premise that
it is.
Yeah, usually that's what's the idea.
That a company would come out.
Yeah, that we create a startup.
Were you at a hackathon this week?
Yeah.
So what did you see?
I didn't see any products.
What did you see?
I don't want to go. Look, I don't want to put anybody down. All right, I didn't see anything that. Look, my point was that we could get a little bit less ambitious about. I mean, I watched a hackathon. They're all patterned after what Silicon Valley does. Okay, like the ultimate hackathon is TechCrunch Disrupt. Right, that would sort of be the, you know, if you were like doing this, that would be the Olympics of hackathons. All right. You know, or Y Combinator would be another one, right?
Yeah.
Or Tech Stars, or I mean, they're all over the country, right? And so we're doing them in academia now, right? And so that's where my concern is, because that's where I am. I'm in academia, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking maybe we could have a different approach and say, instead of trying to throw these kids up out and make them failures, because that's what inevitably these things are,
mm-hmm.
right? Because they don't create startups out of it. Maybe they get a job somewhere in there, or they get somebody's attention. But it's like dogs, trained dogs doing acts for people that don't understand the first thing about what they're talking about, you know? Why can't we just make some tools that are useful to the people that are around them? Like, for example, NYU totally needs an upgrade for its RSS. I mean, I spent an hour or two looking for the RSS feeds for the university this weekend,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I wanted to add them to our eastvillage.org aggregator,
mm-hmm.
because I figured the bloggers of the East Village might find that more interesting if we put some news about us in there,
mm-hmm.
not just news about them, right?
Good idea.
Well, Jay, we don't have them. We don't have RSS feeds at this campus. They're very scattered. There are one or two that you can find here and there.
So you're saying a better hackathon would be, hey, let's get together and improve this thing this institution.
Let's improve NYU.
Yeah.
Let's start right here at home, where we actually have problems that can be solved by this technology.
Mm-hmm.
And you work backwards, right? And you say, well, what was the Internet for in the first place, right? And 99% of what we do with the Internet today is still what it was designed for in the first place. It was designed as a network to help researchers. That's what the Internet was about. Now, we're not researchers so much anymore. We're business people, and we're educators, and we're people who have families who go on vacations, or we want to buy dinners and stuff like that. But we're still doing the same damn thing. We're doing research with it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so if you take the approach as I want to make better research tools, you're going to find a huge fertile ground.
Not only are those the roots of the Internet, but those are the roots of the World Wide Web.
That's what I'm saying.
Timothy Berners-Lee wanted to create a better way of
What are they doing at these hackathons is they're creating the nth derivative of Foursquare. They're creating a Foursquare for apartment rentals in Beirut. You know, it's like, how many ways can you slice this up? And Foursquare, by the way, is not a success yet. So to say that this is a model for...
I got the impression they were more about tools and building apps and clever things that we can use rather than next company.
No.
I'm wrong?
Yeah, no.
I haven't been to one, so...
I actually interviewed Chad Dickerson, who... He's at Etsy now, but he did the first hack day for Yahoo back... That's part of your book, right?
That's part of your book, yeah.
I interviewed him per chapter in the book on Yahoo Hack Day, which is a lot of people credit as the first big sort of... You might call it an internal hackathon. And his take was this is a way to sort of unleash creativity, that you create an artificial constraint, which is the time constraint,
mm-hmm.
And then you kind of basically eliminate virtually all the other constraints. In the case of Yahoo, there was, you know, you were assigned to a particular project and you had a project manager, and, you know, anything you did was supposed to be on that project. And the idea with Yahoo's Hack Day was, well, people have ideas for things that have nothing to do with the project they're assigned to. Why not give them a chance to sort of create a demo, show it off to everyone, and if it turns out to be a good idea, it'll be a feature. And they have had a number of features that came out of this process. And I actually read in Inc. Magazine did a story on the origins of Twitter, and in that story it claimed that Twitter actually did originate from one of these hackathons, that Jack Dorsey, I don't know if you remember, Ev Williams, who's the CEO of Twitter at the time, was doing podcasting software.
Right.
And I guess they were already knew that wasn't quite going to work, and they were groping around for, maybe it was for a new feature for the podcasting, or, you know, maybe it was to take the business in a whole other direction.
It was definitely a side project, yeah.
Yeah, so they convened this hack day, and Dorsey creates Twitter. So, it seems like there are some cases where some cool things can come out. Maybe they needed a bit more direction in this case, or maybe
come on,
it needed
now,
more.
Ryan, experimentation I'm all about. I mean, let's do it. But to the extent that the Yahoo experience actually produced features for their products, that's great. You know, I don't mind a sense of urgency. I've tried it myself at times. What I found, however, when I do it, and this goes back to living video text in the 80s, usually I come back from these, like, intense programming things with nothing, you know? Usually, because products are created by very careful iteration and thought and trial and error, and you don't hit the home run. This is the myth, is that if you just say, put people into a pressure cooker and say, I really want you to be innovative now, that somehow innovation will emerge. It's the opposite of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's you get the innovative ideas when you go on walks, when you get breath, when you listen to other people and get a fresh perspective on how they're looking at the world. So if that happens at these hackathons, that's fantastic, okay? But it isn't what happens.
Now I want you to concentrate on being spontaneous.
Right.
Ryan, what is your
book
about?
Well, I just
got
to say we got about like a minute and a half now.
I want to make sure we get what Brian's book is
about.
I'll
do a quick summary.
60 seconds.
It's about 60 seconds.
It's about Skunk Works project. So we look at a series of projects that are, you know, we kind of define Skunk Works as an ad hoc, a sort of, you know, usually done very quickly, experimental project somehow outside the typical corporate boundaries of a larger company. Uh-huh. So, you know, Gmail was an example of this. Kind of that was done right before Yahoo had done their 20% time. Yahoo Hack Day is another one. Off the bus at Huffington Post was a little bit outside of what the other things Huffington Post was doing.
Cool.
Yeah, so.
Well, we wish you a lot of luck with that book. It sounds like a very interesting book.
And thanks so much for coming on, Ryan. It was a real pleasure having you here.
Yeah.
It was great to be here.
Keep beaming, all right?
Yes. Well, absolutely.
Unplug him now.
Okay, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, Gracie.